Good afternoon and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, your host. As we all know, March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and we are discussing screening, preventing, and treating colorectal cancer for efficient management with Dr. Jimmy J. Wong. Dr. Wong is Director of Hematology and Medical Oncology Fellowship at Levine Cancer Institute. Dr. Wong, welcome to Cure Talks, and thank you so much for joining us, and it's really a pleasure to have you with us today.
Sure, thank you for having me.
The patient caregiver perspective on this panel will be discussed by Amy Marash and Johnny Nelson. Amy is a stage 4 colon cancer survivor who has been free of disease for nearly 10 years. Her experience with colorectal cancer can be seen in her book full of color cartoons and drawings entitled Cancer is So Funny, which is available on Amazon for those who are interested. We also have with us Johnny Nelson. Johnny was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer in 2011. The cancer was successfully removed, post which he underwent 6 months of chemotherapy. Johnny currently serves on the board of directors of Tribal Liaison for Lynch Syndrome International. During month of March, which is as we are discussing Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, he petitions the Clark County Commissioner to replace the outer perimeter iconic yellow lights on the world-famous Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign to blue lights in recognition of Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. So welcome to Cure Talks, Amy and Johnny. We will be addressing questions from the audience towards the end of the discussion. So you can all send in your questions to priya@trialx.com, or you can also post your questions in the comment section and we will try to answer them as time permits. I'll just start off with the discussion without much ado. So Dr. Wong, colorectal cancer is believed to occur in older individuals. However, recent studies and stats suggest that the burden of disease is shifting to the younger people. Is this true? And if so, can you talk a little bit on why this is happening currently?
So it's sort of true, but it's not really true. The median age at diagnosis for colorectal cancer is actually still around 70 years old and continues to be that way. Some studies suggest it may even be a little bit older than that. So most patients that are diagnosed with colorectal cancer are still very much on the older side. Having said that, it does appear that over the course of the last two decades, since about the mid-1990s, more patients have been diagnosed with more younger patients, that is, younger being defined as 55 and under, have been diagnosed with colorectal cancer. So over the last 20 years, certainly there have been more patients that are younger have been diagnosed with colorectal cancer. The reasons for this are not entirely clear. I think that there are hypotheses that relate to either diet and or exercise, recognizing that those are two trends that we've seen in this country over the course of the last 3 to 4 decades, changes in dietary habits, as well as changes in exercise habits. I think that there are other hypotheses that relate to probably still, at least indirectly relating to diet perhaps, that relate to perhaps gut bacteria and whether that has an influence on the development of malignancies. But the honest answer, the most honest answer when I talk to patients or anybody about it is the reality is we don't know.
Mm-hmm. This is my first question is because when I was reading up about colorectal cancer, there was also a hypothesis that probably this kind of change in age group that we are seeing is also maybe because of improved reporting now because of awareness increase. Is that, can we also say something of that sort?
Well, that's always difficult to prove one way or the other, mm-hmm. At least in the short term. You know, I think that if we see that the numbers fall off over the course of the next decade, then that would suggest that there hasn't, in fact, been an increase in the number of total colorectal cancers, just that there was a surge in reporting. But I've not really seen a whole lot that suggests that that's necessarily the case. I think when you look at some of the different curves that have been published through the mm-hmm. Journal of the National Cancer Institute, or through the American Cancer Society. It looks to be a pretty consistent trend over the course of the last several decades, and that would make me really question whether that's just a reporting thing, fact. I think that it does really seem like it's a real effect. And then the other thing that would make me say that is a fair number of these patients have advanced disease when they are diagnosed with their colorectal cancer, which would suggest that that they have symptoms that it's not earlier diagnosis of an early stage disease.
Dr. Fang, what we want to do is actually take a deep dive into some of the available treatments and work that is being done where you're doing at Levine. But before that, just to give the audience an idea, just in layman terms, can you please explain what colorectal cancer is and then touch upon some common symptoms as well as tests that can be done for diagnosis?
So, and this is actually an analogy that one of my colleagues came up with, and I actually like it very much. I think that, if you go back to, 2009 even, for probably even longer than that, if you go back to 2000, pretty much everybody thought of colorectal cancer as being one disease. But what we've learned over the course of the last decade and a half is, as my colleague puts it, colorectal cancer is really more of a family name. And that is an umbrella term for different cancers. Now we know that rectal cancer is not quite the same as a left-sided colon cancer, a sigmoid colon cancer is not quite the same as a right-sided colon cancer, and then there are different mutations that we've learned about. So colorectal cancer is sort of an overarching name for a set of diseases that are very similar but not necessarily exactly the same, and that's also reflected in how they present. So some patients may present with nothing, and we find the cancer has been found at the time of screening. Other patients may have some changes in their bowel habits. They may notice, for example, more bleeding with their bowel movements or pain with their bowel movements. We see that more often with rectal cancers than we do with right-sided colon cancers, for instance. Some patients may present with just more fatigue. They're found to be more anemic. We see that more often with right-sided colon cancers, for example. And then there are some patients that are found when the cancer is already spread, and sometimes patients have symptoms from the fact that their cancer had spread. Was there
Yes, doctor?
Yes, I think that covered the question.
So what are some of the diagnosis tests that we do to actually diagnose this as a colorectal cancer?
Sure. So, again, it depends a little bit from a screening standpoint, from a diagnostic standpoint. Diagnostically, probably the most common test is the colonoscopy, or the shorter version of it is called a flexible sigmoidoscopy, but that doesn't get as far to look inside the colon, so it's not always quite as good a test. Usually we use those when a colon cancer is suspected because a patient is anemic, because a patient is having trouble with their bowel movements. But other tests that can be used for screening, for example, include stool testing, either for blood or colonic type DNA. Once a colon or rectal cancer has been identified, other tests that are used for evaluation of the tumor. The evaluation of the extent of the tumor includes CT scans, the so-called CAT scans, as well as sometimes in some circumstances what's called a PET scan, a positron emission tomography, is used in certain circumstances, but not necessarily as the initial test. One test that we often look to see if it's something that's helpful, although it's not always helpful, is something called a CEA, or carcinoembryonic antigen, which is actually a blood test. But from a diagnostic standpoint, I think the key tests end up being a colonoscopy and then CAT scan.
Okay. We actually have a listener send in a question regarding this. He wants to know, when should a person begin regular colonoscopies? I think, again, this is a screening perspective.
Sure. No, that's a great question. I think it's an important question. Part of it depends on who you ask, and part of it depends on a patient's history. and quite possibly on their ethnicity. So if you go by the most recent American Cancer Society recommendations, everybody should start screening at the age of 45. But there's one very important exception to that, which is patients who have a family history will very much alter family history, or if they have a known genetic mutation, may very much alter those recommendations. So if somebody has a family member who was, for example, 50 when they were found to have a colorectal cancer, then the recommendation is that their first-degree relatives, that is their siblings or their children, should get their first screening study at 10 years younger than that. So a patient who's been identified at age 50, their child should undergo screening not later than age 40. And frankly, if they have any symptoms that are suggestive of colon cancer, they should probably be evaluated sooner. If somebody is known to have what's called Lynch syndrome or hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, the recommendations are to screen even earlier than that. So it does depend on that. And then the recommendation for screening to start at age 45 from the American Cancer Society recommendation. Before that, though, there were suggestions that African Americans should actually be screened younger than the general population. So before 2018, the recommendations were actually to start screening at age 50, and that African Americans should perhaps start screening at age 45. When they moved down the screening recommendation for the general population to 45, there has not been a subsequent recommendation to lower the age in African Americans, although I think that that's certainly something that is being discussed.
So once diagnosed, after all the tests that you mentioned, what is the current standard of care for colorectal cancer?
So that's where things get a little confusing. That's why I go back to that analogy of colorectal cancer as an overarching term for a family of cancers, because what we do depends on the stage of the cancer, and it does depend on where the cancer is. A rectal cancer is treated differently than a colon cancer, what order we do things may depend as well. So if you're talking about a rectal cancer that hasn't spread further than any of the local lymph nodes, for example, what we call stage 2 or stage 3 rectal cancer, then a lot of times patients will end up getting some combination of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. If they have a very, very early stage rectal cancer, they may not need the radiation and the chemotherapy. Or perhaps, although this remains unclear right now, maybe they don't need the surgery. Maybe they can only do the chemotherapy and radiation. On the other hand, a colon cancer depends very much on how advanced the cancer is. So if it's a very localized colon cancer, surgery alone may be good enough. If it's a more advanced colon cancer that's spread to the lymph nodes, then most of these patients will recommend somewhere between 3 and 6 months of postoperative chemotherapy. But if the cancer has gotten away from where it started to a distant organ, to the liver, to the lungs, to the bones, then the role of surgery is less clear, and the primary treatment is chemotherapy, sometimes with the addition of radiation.
We have a listener asking a question regarding this. What are some of the risks of colorectal surgery?
So that depends on where the surgery is being done, like literally anatomically. So for a colon cancer, anytime anybody gets cut on, risks will include pain, will include bleeding, but those are relatively temporary. It will depend on how much of the colon has to come out. Sometimes patients will have some changes in their bowel habits compared to what they were before surgery. But I would say most patients seem to get through it fairly well. I'll defer to our patients who've undergone some of these procedures to give you their viewpoint on that. But for a rectal cancer surgery, it's a little bit of a different ballgame, because as you get closer to the anus, the surgery gets a little bit tougher. The recovery gets to be a little bit tougher, and patients are more likely to have changes with their bowel habits. And there are some patients that the cancer is so close to the anus that the surgeons are not able to reconnect everything, and they have to have a permanent colostomy, a permanent bag for which the stool to exit the body. And certainly from a body image standpoint and many patients, a quality of life standpoint, there's certainly an impact from that.
Mm-hmm. Current standard includes surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. So Dr. Wang, could you also talk a little bit about developments in immunotherapy that can be used or that is being used for colorectal cancer?
So immunotherapy, it's been very interesting over the last 20 years or so that that I've been working in cancer either as a trainee or now on faculty. When I was a trainee, I think that there was a lot of expectation, truthfully more so than in some of the other cancers in which immunotherapy is used, that immunotherapy should work in colon cancers. And that's not been shown, it's not been borne out quite the same way as we've been hoping. The group of patients in which immunotherapy most clearly is helpful are the patients that have what's called Lynch syndrome. In those patients, the current immunotherapies that we have, what we call checkpoint inhibitors, which are anti-CTLA-4 inhibitors, anti-PD-1 inhibitors, they do seem to have a very high likelihood of causing tumors to shrink. But unfortunately, for better, I shouldn't say unfortunately, but for better or for worse, that group of patients in whom immunotherapy seems to work well constitutes maybe 5% of all patients with colorectal cancer. For the rest of the patients with colorectal cancer, it's not yet clear that immunotherapy works. There have been, there's been one fairly large study in which immunotherapy was compared to a standard of care chemotherapy in patients who had pretreated colorectal cancers. And in that study, immunotherapy actually was not better than and looked like it was a little bit worse than standard chemotherapies. And so right now, most patients, it's not at all clear that immunotherapy works in patients with colorectal cancer, although there are still studies that are ongoing as we try to figure out, are there another group of patients in whom it works better? Are there ways that we can tweak the immunotherapy to make it work better? And there are a number of studies ongoing, including one study of which the Levine Cancer Institute is a part, in which patients without prior chemotherapy for metastatic disease, so initial chemotherapy for metastatic disease, receive a standard chemotherapy with or without an anti-PD-1 inhibitor. But we'll see whether that actually works better.
What about CAR T-cell therapy, Dr. Wang, because we've discussed CAR T on this platform many times before. Is there a rationale that says that CAR T may work in colorectal cancer?
So I would say that I would say the answer is too soon to say whether it works. I think the rationale for the hope that it will work is the same underpinnings that led us to believe that that vaccine therapies can work in colorectal cancer. There are studies that have suggested that the immune system can respond to colorectal cancer, so that certainly would be the underpinning of why it's absolutely worth exploring. I think that the issue with CAR T will be, number one, will it or any other immunotherapy work? And that's very much an open question. And then for CAR T in particular, is going to be the toxicity question as well. So I think it's very, very much too early to say. I think that they are just starting the earliest studies in patients with solid tumors. And, we look forward to the opportunity to have good results, but certainly that information is not available and probably won't be for a little while.
So, Dr. Wang, I want to prod this a little further. So, what are the potential implications if we say that CAR T cell therapy is proven to be effective for colorectal cancer, and what are the implications for other solid tumors in general if CAR T works?
Well, I think that the implication for any treatment that works, whether it's CAR T or some other immunotherapy or some targeted therapy, is obviously will be able to improve patient outcomes. I think that still remains to be that's still a big if right now. If something does work, then the question is, where does it fit in? Where does it work? When you look at CAR T and some of the hematologic malignancies, it's not necessarily the first treatment, or it's not clear that it's the first treatment that one should be using. Those same questions will come up. Should there be evidence that CAR T works in colorectal cancer or some other solid tumor?
Yes. Thank you, doctor. So one of the risk factors for colorectal cancer is a family history of the disease, as you just mentioned some time back. So what are some of the recommended genetic evaluations for such people?
So it depends. So I guess there's two ways that I can answer that. One is it does depend a little bit on the family history. All the specific family history, there are certain patterns that we may think about depending on a patient's family history. For example, with regards to uterine cancer, may push point us in the direction towards Lynch syndrome. A very young onset for colon cancer may push us towards familial adenomatous polyposis. But the reality is, we at this point, for the most part, when a patient comes in, if they have a family history that is suggestive, or if they're very young, we'll usually send off a panel of many genes. I don't want to call it a fishing expedition, but trying to make sure that we've covered all of our bases so that we're not missing a possibility. And so patients get sent off for a panel. It's not usually sending off looking for just one gene or six genes or something like that.
So we have a listener send in a question. I know it's kind of resonates with what you just said, but he wants to know how important is getting genetic counseling for colorectal cancer screening?
So I don't think that it's necessary to, if I'm understanding the question correctly, I don't think it's necessary to have genetic counseling for patients that are just undergoing screening. I think the importance of genetic counseling is for patients who've been diagnosed with colorectal cancer to undergo genetic counseling. Now, having said that, if a patient is known to have an increased genetic risk for a colorectal cancer, that will absolutely influence the timing of screening. If a patient is known to have Lynch syndrome, as I mentioned, if they're known to have familial adenomatous polyposis, then they are recommended to start screening sooner than the general population. If somebody has a known genetic predisposition, then that does influence screening recommendations. But I don't recommend that somebody goes to genetic counseling just because they're getting screening.
Yeah, right. There is emerging evidence of clinical relevance of biomarkers in colorectal cancer, but apparently no widespread adoption into clinical practice. So, Doctor, can you talk a little bit about where we are in terms of molecular targeting, biomarkers, and personalized therapy in colorectal cancer?
Actually, I would disagree that biomarkers haven't necessarily gotten to widespread adoption in colorectal cancer, although I will acknowledge that it's probably not as universal as we would like. There are always stories and statistics of some small group of patients providers who don't obtain what I think most people would agree are standard of care biomarkers. So there are really two main biomarkers that we'll test for. Now these are tumor biomarkers, not blood test biomarkers. Unfortunately, there aren't any universal blood test biomarkers at this point. But the tumor biomarkers that are usually tested for, first of all, end up being what's called for microsatellite instability. That may help us determine which patients may have Lynch syndrome. It does help us make decisions with regards to some patients that may benefit from postoperative chemotherapy, or more to the point, don't benefit from postoperative chemotherapy. And that may also suggest a group of patients that are more susceptible, more amenable to receiving immunotherapy. So the microsatellite instability testing is one set of biomarkers that I think is generally tested for. And I think is, again, it may not be universal because every so often I'll see a patient that didn't have that evaluated, but much more often than not, they are tested. And I think most oncologists would agree everybody should. The second, at least with regards to colorectal cancer, the second one that we test for universally, we should be testing universally, and occasionally we'll see folks that haven't, but that's a minority of patients of providers in my experience, is something called KRAS mutations or RAS mutations.
RAS.
And And those RAS mutations, it doesn't tell us who will benefit from different therapies, but it will tell us which patients are not likely to benefit from what we call epidermal growth factor, or EGFR, receptor inhibitors, drugs like panitumumab or cetuximab. If a patient has a RAS mutation, they will not respond to those therapies. And so, again, it doesn't tell us who should be treated, but it does give us an idea of who shouldn't be treated. And so with those types of markers, I think that that helps us with personalizing therapy and trying to figure out what the best treatments are, or at least can we avoid treating patients with something that's not going to work.
Thank you, Doctor. I have just one more question before I hand it over to Amy and Johnny for their questions. Just directly, you're going to screening for and prevention, preventing colorectal cancer. My question is it really possible to prevent colorectal cancer?
So yes, in some patients it is. Not every case is preventable. I feel fairly comfortable in saying that, but some cases are. And I think that one of the things that you see is that there has been a decrease in the group of patients who are over 50 over time. There is a decreasing incidence of colorectal cancer, even though there's been an increase in the younger patient population. And the data suggests that that is because there are fewer cases being diagnosed because they're being prevented. And the sense from the data is that that prevention is because of colonoscopies finding precancerous polyps in the colon, and then removing them before they can turn into cancer. And so that, to me, is really the biggest importance of patients getting their screening colonoscopies. Yes, we can identify cancer sooner, but can we also identify precancerous lesions, get those lesions taken out so that they never develop into colon cancers? So that's really the number one way of trying to prevent colon cancers. I think that there's some data suggesting that aspirin may decrease the risk of colon cancers. That's clearest in patients who've already had a colon cancer in the past, that we can definitely prevent some of those precancerous lesions, but it's less clear that holds true for the general population. The same is true for vitamin D, although the data there is much softer. So I would say colonoscopies and removing colon precancerous polyps is one way that we can prevent colon cancers. And there's some suggestion that aspirin may, although again, that's clearest for patients who've had prior colon cancer themselves, it's not as clear in the general population that aspirin will prevent colon polyps.
Thank you, Dr. Huang. Now, Amy, I'll hand it to Amy. Amy, you can ask your question.
Hi, yeah. Hello, I'm Amy Marish. Actually, Dr. Huang treated me in 2009 for colon cancer. At that time, when I was diagnosed, I was 58, which I guess, according to what you guys said, was not pretty near the considered young. I have two questions. One is, what would you recommend for my kids who are in their 30s? When I was diagnosed, I had no known risk factors, but certainly my kids must now. What do you think they should do?
Actually, it should still be the general recommendations because you were 58 when you were diagnosed. 58 minus 10 is 48. So, and we may have talked about, I'm sure we talked about it before. And at that point in time, what that would have been, is we would have told them, yes, they need to screen sooner than the general population. But now that they've moved the age down for the screening of the general population, the numbers would match. So I would actually say they should start screening at age 45, like the general population. With the other caveat being that, of course, if they have any symptoms that are suggestive of colon cancer with regards to change in their bowel movements, the size, the color, pain, that regardless of how old they are, then they should absolutely get evaluated. And you can debate whether a colonoscopy at that time would be screening or actually diagnostic, but either way, one would recommend that they do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And also thank you for the great treatment that I received, because here I am almost 10 years out. So that's all good news. The other thing I was curious about is the risk, the things you mentioned, you know, the changes in the bowel and that kind of thing. If someone in their 50s or 60s goes to a gastroenterologist, I assume it's pretty easy to get a scheduled colonoscopy and your insurance would approve, but how about people in their 20s and 30s and 40s? Is it harder for young people to, one, convince their physicians that it would be a good idea to do a colonoscopy, and two, to convince their insurance?
So that's a great question, and in some ways I'm not the best placed person to answer that because once I when the patients that are seeing me have already been diagnosed,
mm-hmm.
certainly some of them you hear stories about they felt patients who felt like they something was wrong and their provider you know said it's just hemorrhoids
mm-hmm.
or not, but by the same token last week I saw a patient who had changes in his but you know, bowel movements, you know, had some blood over the course of 6 months, and then he decided that maybe it was a problem, and then he would present to somebody who then pretty much scoped him right away. So I think that it's probably some of both. Somebody assumes that they're in their 20s, so I can't have cancer, or the doctor says you're in your 20s, that can't be cancer. There's probably some of each. But having said that, I've certainly not heard any issues from a insurance standpoint, although I'm sure there are stories out there that will contradict me, but I've not heard any stories of any of the patients that I've seen that says, no, I had rectal bleeding, rectal pain with bowel movements, and my insurance wouldn't let me get the test because at that point it's diagnostic and not screening.
And yet you mentioned that many of the young people who develop colorectal cancer, when they're diagnosed, they're already at stage 3 or 4, which kind of suggests they didn't get early screening or early diagnosis.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. One could postulate, although that's not at all clear, that is the cancer more aggressive or is it biologically different so that more patients that are younger actually have more advanced disease. Period.
You've seen a lot of patients through all the age groups. Do you have a? I know you're not likely to do a hunch. You're kind of data driven, but what's your hunch?
there have been studies that have reported both things. Some studies have suggested that there's not a clear difference in the biologic activity of the colorectal cancer. There are a couple of studies that suggest that younger patients do have more aggressive colorectal cancer. So. Yeah, so there's data on both sides, and I'm not sure that I would say that it's not clear to me, one way or the other. But there's data on both supporting both arguments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm willing to turn it over to Johnny if he's got a question.
Thank you, Amy. Johnny, you can ask your questions.
Yes. Thank you for having me on the show this afternoon. My history with colon cancer is that I was diagnosed in 2011 with a stage 3 colon cancer. In my case, my cancer was found by a colonoscopy, which there's a very strong history of family in my family of colon cancer. I have lost two siblings in their early ages of 30, in their 30s. My mother had colon cancer twice. The first time was when she was about 40 years old. The second time was when she was about 76. She's also a one-time breast cancer survivor. She continues to do very well. Out of losing my first sister when she was about age 32 to colon and stomach cancer, there was 11 siblings in my family. I was the oldest of 11. That her doctor recommended that I have a colonoscopy as soon as possible. At that time, I was in my late 30s. Had the colonoscopy done. There was one polyp found. Evidently, This particular polyp I had was more of a flat style of polyp, which could not be removed during the procedure, so I had to have it surgically removed. That was about 1998. After that, the doctor recommended that I have a colonoscopy every 8 to 10 years. I was not comfortable with that. I moved from the previous state I was in, which is New Mexico, into Las Vegas. I started my own screenings between every 2 to 3 years. 2011 is when I was diagnosed, or I went in for my what I call my regular screening. I was approaching my third year when they found this large mass on my right side. So since then, I have been diagnosed with Lynch syndrome. So that's kind of what's led me up today's show, as far as being an advocate for colon cancer and for Lynch syndrome. My first question is, with the new data coming out as far as younger people, at least a recommendation for people age 45 and under, you've kind of touched a little bit on that, but my first question is how are the doctors now? Are they encouraging 45-year-olds to get at least 45 and younger? I know you touched on it a little bit.
So, yeah, I'm a little bit ill-placed to say broadly from a primary care environment what they're saying, but certainly from our end, yes, we absolutely advocate for 45. I don't necessarily advocate for younger, although I think that, as I alluded to, I think this question about whether or not African Americans should be screened younger is still an open question. I think that, the importance of this kind of a program, in most programs, is the importance of getting the word out there, because, the dissemination, there's so much information that exists. That I don't envy primary care providers and what they need to do in terms of taking care of patients, keeping up on all of the information. And it's not easy for them to keep up with everything. But having said that, this is obviously something that I view as being important to disseminate on both ends. So for patients to be there, to be able to be their own advocates about this is a recommendation, standard recommendation. So I need to be doing it. No, it's not still 50 years old, although in fairness, the recommended change just came about last June. So, not everybody may be entirely familiar with that, but absolutely, I do recommend 45 for a general population. Now, if somebody with Lynch syndrome, again, the recommendation is going to be different. I think the recommendation is still age 30, depending on what the fit the specifics of the family history is, and there's some people that they'll recommend, starting with Lynch, starting screening from age 18. It just sort of depends on the specifics.
Right. Next question is in regards to younger people being diagnosed with colon cancer. What is the thought as far as why? Could it be something as far as diet, maybe the types of food?
So, as I mentioned, it's not entirely clear. I don't know that any – so the one – so there have been a couple of things that have been suggested dietarily. One, broadly speaking, has been sort of a low-fiber, high-fat diet. It has been one set of suggestions. Second set of suggestions that it may have to do with red meat. But I think that outside of diet, and I tend to also believe that it's not simply diet but also exercise. Has a role in this as well, or lack of exercise probably has a role in it. There was a paper that was just published within the last week or two suggesting, at least in females, that obesity may have something to do with a younger age of diagnosis, which obviously mm-hmm. could be the confluence of both both diet as well as exercise. So, but why that would be specifically for females, not males, one could put, raise that, say that's open to question. One could suggest estrogen has something to do with it, but older studies suggested that estrogen may be more protective than anything. So I think that the whole picture is still a little bit hazy, but certainly there are some suggestions that a high a high-fat, low-fiber diet is not helpful. Eating a lot of red meat is not helpful. Smoking is not helpful. But I think that it's hard to say that there's definitely one cause.
Okay. All right. My next question has to do with maybe not a certain brand of PrEP, but maybe a procedure of PrEP. I've been through so many in my personal experience here. I do a colonoscopy now every year. So early on, PrEP was one of my biggest concerns because I believe that if a person doesn't do a very good PrEP, they're just basically wasting everybody's time to a point. My question is there a certain particular brand or procedure that you might recommend?
No. The simple version is no. I'm not sure that I can recommend that one is necessarily better than others. I've had some patients where one type is better and other patients where another, that type didn't work well for them and a different one worked better for them. So no, it's a little bit hard for me to say one is necessarily better than the other.
Right. And I guess the reason why I bring up that particular question for me is in my case, the style of polyp I had was a flat style. And from what I understand, sometimes it can be overlooked. And so, you know, if a person doesn't have a very good PrEP, that may get missed.
Absolutely true. And I think that just points out the importance of it being as good a PrEP as we can. But it's not something that's easily predictable.
Okay. All right. My next question has to do with colonoscopies. Ever since I started young, or as far as like in my late 30s with colonoscopies, my siblings actually, they had both colon and stomach cancer. And my question is do you recommend an endoscopy along with the colonoscopy?
For somebody with Lynch syndrome, that's a great question. For somebody who doesn't have Lynch syndrome, no. For Lynch syndrome, I do generally have my patients get upper endoscopy at least once every couple of years. I don't necessarily recommend it every year, though.
Right. Okay. Thank you. My last question is: do you find that are more doctors looking at family history and recommending further testing, such as genetic testing?
From an oncologist standpoint, I think yes. Both that as well as age. I definitely think that is something that we talk about more now than we did 10 years ago and more than 20 years ago. So I think that's definitely true. Again, from a primary care provider standpoint, that's not as clear to me, although it certainly is a checkbox in most electronic records. And so I think it does at least come up.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your answers. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny. So, Dr., we'll go on to the audience questions now. We have quite a few of them which have been sent in, and I think we did answer some as well. The first one is colorectal cancer in younger adults different from those in older adults?
That's a great question. I think that to some extent the answer is yes. There have been a couple of different studies that suggest that there are some different mutations that we see in younger patients than we see in older patients. It's not absolute. It's not absolutely true. There are some younger patients whose tumor genetic profile looks the same as an older patient's would. But I think that as a population, there's certainly studies that suggest that there are different gene mutations that we see in younger patients than we see in older patients. And some of those do have therapeutic implications. So from that standpoint, yes, there are some differences in younger versus older.
We have another question, which is, I think you did mention vitamin D some time back. So the question is, does vitamin D really protect against colorectal cancer?
That's not that clear at this point. I think that the main basis for suggestions for vitamin D is the Nurses' Health Study that suggested that nurses back in the 80s and 90s who were taking vitamin D regularly had a lower risk of having colon polyps. And so the thought was and has been that decreased risk of colon polyps would translate into a decreased risk of colon cancer. Having said that, that's not that clear. That second step has followed. That is to say, even though there was a decreased risk of colon polyps in those nurses, it's not as clear that there's decreased risk of colon cancer. And there have been a couple of other similar studies that have looked at vitamin D, and they haven't had the same association with the decreased risk of colon polyps. So I think that it's not clear that vitamin D prevents colon cancer. So the context that I've always discussed it with my patients, and I think I had the same discussion with Mrs. Marish once upon a time, was that if there are other reasons for somebody to be on vitamin D, I don't think that it'll hurt.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very difficult to say, yes, you should absolutely take vitamin D because it will definitely help. I think that part is less clear. If somebody has osteoporosis or is at risk for osteoporosis and that's a reason for them to be on vitamin D, an additional benefit, something else to try to get them, an additional potential benefit, an additional reason to try to encourage them to take something that may be beneficial as well. Maybe it'll help with the colon polyps as well, but I don't usually tell patients, yes, you should do this to prevent colon polyps. It's maybe it'll help, but it's certainly not my first strongest recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, doctor. The next question is, I think you touched on this as well, about a study on physical activity reducing growth of colorectal tumor cells. So the question is, can Dr. Huang comment on this?
I'm sorry, can you...
I think the news article... Yeah, that's fine. The news article actually talked about short bursts of intense physical activity reducing the growth of colorectal tumor cells. So can Dr. Huang comment on this?
I'm not sure that the data is very clear, in my opinion, about whether one type or another of a physical activity is preferred. And with regards to duration, with regards to intensity, it's a hard thing to study in terms of ultimately what the impact on a colon cancer cell ends up being. So I think that when it comes to people, it's hard to say, no, you must do this type of activity in order to benefit, because I think the data is not at all that clear. My personal discussion with patients tends to be, it's most important that you're doing something from a physical activity exercise standpoint. I think that it's hard to prescribe one over the other, and because not all patients can do all of them anyways. But I think that I would say that it's not to my mind and my studies, I don't think that it's clear that one type of physical activity is or exercise is better than the others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, so we have another question, which is, what are some of the things a person can do to reduce the risk of colon cancer? So are there any guidelines?
So from a prevention standpoint, from somebody who has no clear risks or no personal history, I would say that there's certainly no specific guidelines. I think that the general discussions that are had are high fiber, low fat diets are beneficial. I think that decrease would suggest that I know how much red meat anybody is eating, but minimizing red meat intake may be beneficial. I'm not one who says you can't have anything. Mrs. Marish has heard me say in the past, I believe most things in moderation are fine. I think that doesn't mean you can't have any red meat, but I'm not sure you want to be going on a diet where you're having red meat every night or, you know, every other night or something like that. But I think that a high fiber is a beneficial thing. Low fat is a beneficial thing. I think that lower red meat is a beneficial thing. And then, as the other preceding question alluded to, I think exercise is an important thing. Those are probably the main things that one can do to prevent that, as well as, again, doing the screenings, because I think that if we can find a polyp before it's before it can turn into cancer, we can prevent cancer in that fashion.
Thank you, Doctor. I have just one last question before we can wrap up. So that question is, what are some of the clinical trials that patients should be tracking?
I'm sorry, what are some of the critical what?
Clinical trials.
Oh, clinical trials.
Clinical trials,
So, it depends on the patient. It depends on their it does depend on their genetic profiles specifically. One of the things that's become challenging in the treatment development of treatments in patients with colon cancer ends up being that because we're now looking at smaller and smaller groups based on some of the genetic profile findings, not everything that we learn will necessarily apply to everybody. So we'll see. I think that when we're looking at the rectal cancer studies, I think that the most exciting ones that we're waiting to get the studies finished and then be able to evaluate end up relating to preoperative. Do we give chemotherapy before surgery, before radiation, before surgery? Because ultimately, part of the question with those kinds of studies may lead to the possibility of, well, does everybody need surgery to begin with for rectal cancer? And the potential, with the potential being that maybe they don't all need surgery. So that's really one of the biggest ones that we're looking forward to as a community. But frankly, those results probably won't be available for a couple of more years. And even that will be some of the preliminary results. The second set of studies that I think more universally may be applicable will be the one I alluded to earlier for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, getting initial chemotherapy with or without immunotherapy, because that's a study that, number one, it's looking at immunotherapy in the early setting when patients haven't had a lot of chemotherapy, and then secondly, because it's what we would call mutation agnostic. It doesn't matter what a patient's tumor mutation profile is. And so it may be broadly applicable. And so I think we'll learn a lot from that pair of studies that may apply to a lot of different patients. But it'll still be a while before we get those results.
Thank you, Dr. Huang. According to the American Cancer Society, there'll be more than 100,000 new cases of colon cancer and more than 44,000 rectal cancer cases diagnosed in 2019. And colorectal cancer may cause over 50,000 deaths this year. However, 90% of colorectal cancers are preventable, but one out of three people who should be screened aren't doing it. So with the message of screen, prevent, and treat colorectal cancer, Dr. Huang, thank you so much for sharing treatment options and the latest research, trials, and screenings in colorectal cancer with us today. Amy and Johnny, thanks a lot for your participation and bringing in the patient's perspective into this discussion. We would also like to thank Levine Cancer Institute and also the audience for all the questions that you've sent in. The talk will be available on curetalks.com. Please visit our website for details on all upcoming talks. Thank you and have a great evening, everyone. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.